Germaine Greer, writer, feminist, and now environmentalist. It's Friday, July 11th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Did you know Germaine Greer is not just a feminist writer?
I've traveled a lot in Australia, and I've traveled quite a bit in the rest of the world. And everywhere I go, I see disaster. And you think, give me something, just a little thing, that I can fix.
So she set about fixing part of a rainforest. Also on the show, snapshots from the Middle East. We hear what it was like today in Gaza City.
The streets are completely empty. Most of the shops are closed. People are just staying home because they are so scared to move around.
And at a bar in Tel Aviv.
This is the bubble, and people here want to live. We're not afraid.
Plus, we visit with Jamaican guitar great Ernest Ranglin.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You've got The World on your radio. The Gaza Strip is about twice the size of Washington, D.C., and it's packed with some 1.8 million people. Imagine a city that size with only two ways in or out for people, and bombs falling all around you. That's where we start our coverage today of what's happening in the Middle East. Earlier, I spoke with Arwa Mana. She's a resident of Gaza, and she works with the international charity Oxfam. But like many in Gaza City, her work routine has been seriously disrupted, so we reached her at her home there. Tell us, first of all, what's the situation in your neighborhood, Arwa?
The situation is very confusing. All of a sudden, I can hear very huge explosions very close to my place. And then it goes to the calm for maybe 5 minutes, maybe 6 hours. And then it goes again to huge booms. In my neighborhood, the streets are completely empty. Most of the shops are closed. People are just staying home because they are so scared to move around.
So lots of people staying in place. I mean, how does that just disrupt daily life?
People cannot go to their work. Most of, if not all, international organizations close down their offices, and people are working from home. People depend for their daily income on their daily work, and now they are not able to go to their work, which means that it has a huge impact on sometimes and in some places on the availability of food in their houses.
Well, it's Ramadan too, and that means people are fasting during the day, but typically Muslims have a big family meal or even a banquet for the evening meal, iftar. Well, what about now?
Exactly. It's Ramadan time, and now it's the fasting time for Muslims. Ramadan is a very family time. People visit each other. People go out after eating. Now all this doesn't happen. For example, I have my family 5 minutes away from my place, and I cannot even visit them since the beginning of the military operation in Gaza.
Yeah, so what do you do to kind of substitute for that big family meal at the end of the fasting?
Well, we are trying to substitute this with phone calls, but most of the phone calls are happening now to ask one question, whether the person we are calling is okay or not, because most of the time we hear about airstrikes next to my family house, for example, or a friend house. So even these phone conversations, they are all about checking whether they are fine or not, whether they feel safe or not, whether they have anything lacking in terms of food, or water, or basic needs or not. It's not anymore about how they are spending their time or how they are enjoying this very special time of the year, which is Ramadan.
So where are people getting like basic foodstuffs? Are any markets open?
Well, there are few markets open. The problem is how to move and to go to the market. It's very dangerous to move in the streets. It's not only dangerous at nighttime. It's also in the daytime. Because you can never know where and when the airstrike will take place. For example, we have one of our beneficiaries, for Oxfam beneficiaries, who receives food vouchers on a weekly basis. 2 days ago, he was killed in an airstrike on his way back from the market while he was shopping for food.
Yeah, and there are many, many sad stories like that. I mean, as you point out, you work for Oxfam, and your organization typically assists people often with food. Do you have inventories of food, or are you also hindered? Is Oxfam also hindered by the attacks and unable to find food to distribute?
Well, usually we work through our local partners. We have local partners working in different sectors. For example, for the food security partners, they told us that they have enough stock of food, which can be enough for the coming 1 or 2 weeks.
And what about those notorious tunnels running between Egypt and Gaza? I mean, are they being used at all to transport supplies into the Gaza Strip?
Well, most of them have been destroyed. Food items in Gaza stopped to depend on the tunnels during the last year. And now it's mainly depending on the local production and the goods that are coming from Israel. And on the same note, the only good crossing connecting Gaza with Israel have been closed during the last 2 days. And if this continue, this will have a huge impact on the availability of food in Gaza.
Well, Arwa Manna, stay safe, and thank you very much for telling us about the situation in your neighborhood in Gaza. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
While residents of Gaza must cope with the threat from Israeli airstrikes, people in Israel are coping with the threat of ongoing rocket fire from militants in Gaza. Residents of Tel Aviv, for example, are being urged to rush to bomb shelters when warning sirens blare, and that's not something people there are used to, as Rebecca Collard reports.
It's almost midnight in central Tel Aviv, and a dozen or so young Israelis are lounging on folding chairs on the street patio of a small bistro. It's a world away from the devastation in the Gaza Strip, or even Israel's southern communities, where sirens ring regularly and residents are accustomed to taking shelter.
This is the bubble.
That's Moti Avraham. He works here.
People here want to live. So the restaurant is busy, the bar is busy. We're not afraid.
In the last decade, Tel Aviv has been spared much of the rockets and sirens that are common for Israelis in the north and the south in times like these, and escaped the worst violence of the Second Intifada. But in recent days, the bubble has been challenged by Hamas's upgraded arsenal. These sirens urge Tel Aviv to take shelter from incoming rockets. It's something residents here aren't used to. For the first time, rockets fired from the Gaza Strip are reaching even farther north than this coastal city. But still, for the most part, people here seem unfazed. The beach is busy for a Thursday afternoon. Talma Lieberman plays in the water with her six-year-old son.
I choose not to operate from fear. A feeling of safety, a feeling that there's something that protects us and nothing will harm us.
This choice to ignore danger comes easily here, in part due to the now regular sound of Israel's Iron Dome intercepting rockets mid-air. With faith in this system, many people saunter rather than run towards shelters. And some, like 26-year-old Luna Frankel, don't seek shelter at all. The Iron Dome shoots down the rockets, she tells me. I'm more likely to die in a car accident now than from a rocket. Israel first installed this defense system to protect the southern region in 2011. The system has since been extended north and has intercepted at least 70 rockets bound for urban centers in recent days. There have been no Israeli casualties. So far, in this latest escalation of violence, Israel's strategy has been airborne. While the Iron Dome intercepts incoming rockets, Israel's Air Force has been pounding the Gaza Strip, killing around 100 Gazans, according to Palestinian health officials. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has indicated the possibility of a ground invasion. He's called up thousands of reserve soldiers and amassed tanks and artillery on the edge of the blockaded strip. But on a recent night in Tel Aviv, many were watching the World Cup, not the news.
I think they've been warned quite a few times that to stop sending missiles to Israel, and they haven't done it.
Like most Israelis, Nir Avrahami says he's supportive of the airstrikes he believes are targeting Hamas. But his support stops short of risking Israeli lives in a ground offensive.
Once you go on the ground, you're going to start losing soldiers, right? And if we're going to lose 150 soldiers, right, I think this country will be crying.
For most in Tel Aviv, airstrikes in Gaza and the Iron Dome above are enough to defend the country, and there's less support for escalation to full-blown war. Even as the government considers a ground offensive, in Tel Aviv, there's a sense of insulation. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard, Tel Aviv.
The World Health Organization today issued some strong advice. Okay, basically gave an order as part of its global campaign to prevent HIV and AIDS. The WHO's message to sexually active gay men is take your antiretrovirals. Yes, even if you are not HIV positive. We're talking about a preventive treatment known as pre-EP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis. Dr. Gottfried Hernschall is the director of the WHO's HIV department. He says the recommendation was prompted by some disturbing health trends.
What we have seen in the last couple of years is an incredibly strong increase in new infections in gay men, basically. And we've seen this in major cities all over the world. We've seen this in the United States. We have seen this in Europe. We see it in Asia. We see it in some places, even in Africa, Mombasa, etc. So in response to that, we really were trying to see what could be sort of the arsenal of interventions that could be made available to men who have sex with men. And in that context, following a study that showed strong efficacy of using antiretroviral drugs, which also forms part of the treatment of HIV-positive people, has a strong prevention effect.
Right.
So what we are recommending, just to say, is that gay men consider this as an option in case they do not want to or cannot take other options and other means, specifically condoms. So it's by no means an order. WHO makes recommendations, and this recommendation is really just to add as an additional option in the context of a broader range of interventions that, of course, has to include condoms.
I'd like you to unpack the use of these pre-EP pills. How effective are they?
In study settings, they are actually very effective. What obviously is true for pre-exposure prophylaxis, taking these pills that need to be taken every day, is true for like any other prevention intervention, including condoms. If you use them, they're very effective. If you don't use them, if you don't take the pills every day, obviously they won't help. The challenge will be to translate what we have seen in studies as a highly efficacious intervention into a real effective interventions in reality in the field.
What do you say, though, to opponents of your guidelines, basically arguing that gay men would stop using condoms or they might forget to take one pill and then become infected? What do you think?
Obviously, not everybody likes it. Obviously, not everybody wants to do it. Certain people think this is an intervention they would consider, and some people are already doing it. So we are seeing a broad range of opinions here. So clearly, this means that we need to do a lot of more outreach. We need to share the information. And again, it's a choice. It's an individual choice that usually should be made with a provider, so that also certain measures can put in place that these people are helped to adhere to these drugs and that these people are also seeing this as very often as an interim measure. We don't expect that a gay man takes this for the rest of his life. Life changes. There may be periods where somebody takes this and then stops taking it because the risk may change.
Right. You say it's a choice, but do you believe AIDS activists should do everything they can to get the drug in the hands of those who want it?
Certainly, AIDS activists should be doing everything to help the people to protect themselves, to stay healthy and alive. And we have to really look at reality. Why is it that in Bangkok we are seeing incredibly high rates of new infections? Is it that condoms are not available, or is it that they don't want to use condoms? I think it's a combination of things, and the more options we can make available safely, the greater the likelihood will be that we can deal with this surge of new infections.
You know, there's still no cure for HIV. I mean, having worked in this field, is it frustrating to keep playing catch-up?
You're right. There's still no cure. There's quite some research going on to sort of work towards a cure. It's not within immediate reach, that is clear. But in the meantime, we have to do everything we can to turn off the tap. That means to really bring down the number and the rate of new infections and to support people in taking treatment in case they need it. And this is definitely lifelong.
Dr. Gottfried Hernschall is the director of WHO's HIV department. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Still ahead on The World, dancing cheek to cheek in the UK really depends on whose cheek on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. When I grew up in the 70s, my mom had a book on her shelf whose title would intrigue any kid. The Female Eunuch by Australian feminist Germaine Greer. The book's basic message, that the suburban housewife, the Carol Brady stereotype, the nuclear family, it all renders women sexually impotent. It basically turns women into eunuchs. Germaine Greer has defended and also wrestled with that theory for a long time, but a little more than a decade ago, she began wrestling with something more tangible, a piece of land in Queensland, Australia, that she'd fallen in love with.
I've sat down on a rock, and I began to listen to the forest to see how much life it had left in it, the bits of tattered forest that were still there. And this bird came out of the forest, this regent bowerbird, and it danced for me, and it danced all around me. And the whole time it kept looking out of its yellow eye right in my face as if to say, what are you going to do about this? Are you going to help us guys or what?
Wow.
And when I got up from that rock, the property was sold.
Sold to Germaine Greer, that is. She plunked down most of her savings to buy the property, 150 acres of depleted rainforest on the east coast of Australia. It had been reduced to scrubland after decades of logging, quarrying, and misguided attempts to grow European fruits and plants. Greer wondered if it could be restored. Her new book about the effort is called White Beach, The Rainforest Years. She says just getting to her patch of land is a bit of a trek.
If you go inland, you keep climbing and climbing until you come to the ring dikes of this very, I think it's supposed to be the largest intact caldera left in the world. And it was where a huge shield volcano blew its head off millennia ago. And gradually these rich basalt volcanic soils have weathered down to a fairly spectacular crater that I think is like the socket of a tooth. You know, when you have your tooth out, you've got this kind of bony socket. Well, it's a bit like that. And this is a subtropical rainforest, Gondwanan forest. Gondwanan forest is typical of the vegetation that covered most of the world at the time of the breakup of the great continents Laurasia and Gondwana.
This rainforest on the east coast of Australia was depleted. What did you do to it? And what was your vision when
I haven't
when
finished
you saw it?
Yet. Hang on. It takes 800 years to restore a rainforest. So I'm currently studying how not to die so I can keep the whole show on the road.
Well, good luck with that.
Actually, I'm not sure that I want to live to be 800 years old, which is how long it takes to do a forest.
So if I get this right, your vision, Germaine Greer, was to buy a piece of this messed up environment and bring it back into its original state, which is only a few years old now. That doesn't happen that quickly. Why did you do this? I imagine you had people telling you, don't invest $500,000 in this land. Why do this? Why was it so important to you?
I've traveled a lot in Australia, and I've traveled quite a bit in the rest of the world. And everywhere I go, I see disaster. And you get so worn down by it that it breaks your heart. And you think, we can't go on like this. It just hurts. And you just start to think, give me something, just a little thing that I can fix. Show me that there's a way back out of this.
I need to ask you this. Did you need, do you think, to see some concrete result of activism? Like maybe were the results of the fight for women's equality maybe too nuanced for you to kind of feel satisfied with?
Oh, for me, it's quite a different thing. I'm not an equality feminist. I don't understand the concept. I think it's bankrupt. I'm a liberation feminist. And for me,
what does that mean?
Well, it means that you actually develop whole new ways of living, that you don't make war, especially now that we make war on civilian populations, that you actually think in terms of building structures by cooperation, which is how they got built in the first place.
Would you say there is a connection, though, between your environmental work and your activism in years past?
Sure.
What is that connection?
I was always a talker rather than a doer, but now I'm a doer. And I get very we've had all kinds of environmental movements that have had conferences and rushed around all over the world and never planted a single tree. At some point, I needed to see something grow. I needed to feel that I was on the right side. And I've been a gardener for years, and that consists of making things grow in places where they don't want to be. Suddenly, in the rainforest, I realized that if I could find out what should be there and reintroduce it or strengthen its representation among the plants already there, that it would start doing it for me, which is exactly what happened. the forest just took off. And I now realize that the forest is calling the shots.
Mm.
Now, that sounds a bit crazy, but if you remember Lynn Margolis, and I won't be very surprised if you don't.
I don't.
Her argument was that the world came from its primordial slime, its primordial organism, the algae that covered it, and they cooperated and they diversified and they built into complex organisms. And she, I mean, there are people who believe in Gaia and all that sort of thing. I don't think we have to make it into a kind of mysticism or a fake mythology. But you do realize when you're working in a forest that everything is linked to everything else.
Can I just say how odd it is to be speaking with Germaine Greer about slime molds? I mean, you are best associated with your groundbreaking book, The Female Eunuch, and feminist activism since the mid-60s. Do you feel like instead of becoming more internationalist, you've kind of settled into Queensland? Am I incorrect in kind of characterizing your life that way, your activism that way these days?
Well, I'm old. I'm allowed. I'm allowed to dig my little burrow and get in. But in fact, our next big challenge is to find more rainforest. I'm very interested in trying to find some land in New Caledonia, for example, that we can restore and protect. Because even a small area, my property in Queensland is only 150 acres. But 50 acres in New Caledonia, where we could keep the extraordinary variety of Gondwanan species alive, would be an insurance against losing them in the future.
Germaine Greer, great to meet you. Thanks so much for the interview. Really appreciate it.
It was a huge pleasure. Thank you.
Germaine Greer's latest book is called White Beach, The Rainforest Years. You can read the book's prologue at PRI.org. A quick note from our irony desk before we head to the break. The famous Running of the Bulls is taking place now in Pamplona, Spain. Like every year, tens of thousands of Spaniards and visitors are there to try and outrun the bulls as they charge through the city's narrow, cobbled streets. In other words, it's a recipe for disaster. So here's the irony part. This year, an American named Bill Hillman got gored. He happens to be the co-author of a book called, drumroll please, How to Survive the Running of the Bulls.
He tripped or may have been pushed over by another runner. We're not quite sure from the film footage. And the bull actually tripped on him as well. And its horn went through his lower thigh and out the other side.
That's Hillman's co-author, Alexander Fisk Harrison. He says, sure, some might criticize Hillman now, but he notes that Hillman was gored while doing the right thing as a Pamplona veteran.
In amongst all the first-time runners who do it for a thrill or because they read too much Hemingway when they were young, there is also a hardcore of veteran runners, and one of their jobs is actually to lure the bulls through so they don't injure all the other people who obviously don't quite know what they're doing.
Hillman's injuries are serious, but not life-threatening, and Fisk Harrison says he's recovering nicely.
He's on very good form, but that might be partly explained by the amount of pain-killing drugs he's had to take.
Sweet dreams, Bill Hillman. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, your pulse is going to quicken as Izzy, our World Cup match-predicting ocelot, picks the winner for this weekend's final.
Izzy has opened the enclosure. He's walking in right now.
So who's it going to be, Germany or Argentina? Izzy's final World Cup pick is coming up right here on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. All good things must come to an end, and so it will be this weekend with the World Cup down in Brazil. On Sunday, Germany and Argentina will battle it out in the final at the famous Maracanã Stadium in Rio. You know what that means, don't you? It's time for a final prediction from our friend Izzy, the Brazilian ocelot at Boston's Franklin Park Zoo. He's been helping us predict the outcome of World Cup matches for the past month. So here we go. We sent our own Bradley Campbell down to the zoo for one last Wildcat play-by-play.
Marketing 2 to Forest 2, we're ready for Izzy.
Izzy has opened the enclosure. He's walking in right now. He's going straight for Argentina. Argentina giving it a sniff right there. Ooh, oh, no, no, no. He has moved away. He is going toward Germany. Oh, he's taking a bite. It's victory. It's victory for Germany. Ladies and gentlemen, can we get some cheers? Can we get some cheers? Germany with the victory. You heard it here from Izzy the Ocelot.
I didn't know ocelots could speak English so well. Berliners are going to go nuts when they hear that. Crazier than David Hasselhoff dancing on the Berlin Wall. If you want to see how Izzy picked Germany to win the World Cup final, we've got the final Izzy video at PRI.org. In just a few minutes, we'll hear more from Izzy and a special announcement about the Brazilian Wildcat that you won't want to miss. But first in the studio with me now is our very own soccer man, William Troop. He's just back from the World Cup action in Brazil. You lining up behind Izzy's prediction, William, or do you think something else is going to happen out there on the pitch on Sunday?
You know, I have to say, I think the Wildcat is on to something. I agree that Germany is the favorite to win on Sunday. They are the hotter team out there. But, you know, strange things can happen in finals. And this final looks to me to be the chance for one of the world's best players ever, Lionel Messi from Argentina, to win his World Cup and finally put to rest all these, you know, impossible comparisons with the previous great, Diego Maradona for Argentina. If Messi's ever going to win a World Cup, this is it. So I think that's going to motivate Argentina to win, and that's who I'm picking for a winner on Sunday.
I think I'm going with you. Anyway, it's just going to be totally exciting on Sunday. Now, you were in Brazil witnessing the World Cup firsthand. What was that like?
In a word, it was awesome. I had a very great visit to Brazil, and as I've said on the show before, I had a really smooth experience. My visits to stadiums and moving around cities, it was all really pretty smooth, pretty according to schedule. Brazilians were absolutely fabulous and very warm and helpful to visitors like myself. So I you know, truly enjoyed the visit and had a great time both watching the soccer and traveling around Brazil.
Now, William, you left before that painful Germany-Brazil match, painful for Brazil anyway. You must have been thinking once you got back to the U.S. just how drastically the mood must have changed in Brazil once that happened. I mean, what do you see happening there now, even if Brazil beats Holland on Saturday for that not very coveted third-place title?
You're absolutely right. When I was in Brazil, it was all party, all pride in the national team, everybody ready to celebrate. You know, now what I'm seeing in the coverage from Brazil is, you know, people are kind of depressed and kind of waking up to the fact that, you know, maybe their team wasn't that great after all. And what I see happening now is that more and more Brazilians are remembering what they were protesting about last year and earlier this year. So some of that is going to start happening again. And one immediate effect that I see happening is political in Brazil. There's an election coming up for which President Dilma Rousseff is a candidate for re-election. And even though she's in the polls, she's still looking good. She's taking one precautionary step, and that is she is not going to Brazil's game on Saturday for the third-place final against the Netherlands. She's going to stay away, even though it's happening in her backyard in the capital, Brasilia. She's going to stay away because the prediction is that if she shows up, she would be booed very loudly by the crowd. So,
wow.
So that's a clear indication of the political setback that this catastrophe in soccer terms is for her.
Well, not to mention possible negative photo ops if she's seen there.
Exactly. So, yeah, she's staying well away.
The world soccer guy, fresh back from Brazil, William Troop. Mucho obrigado.
De nada, Marco.
Well, as William mentioned, Brazil is already feeling that World Cup hangover, and that got us thinking about the effects, both political and cultural, that a momentous sporting victory or defeat can have on a nation. The world's Google fellow, David Conrad, has created a fantastic web graphic to highlight some instances of this throughout history. You can see that at PRI.org, and David Conrad joins me now in the studio. So what fired up your curiosity in the first place, David, about how sporting victories or losses can have these effects on a country?
Well, and I should say that how I found a way to spend an entire morning researching sports is probably more impressive than the graphic. I came up because in the newsroom, ever since the Brazil-Germany blowout, we have been wrestling with the national implications of the match, whether this bitterly disappointing end to the tournament, which was already a widely unpopular and costly project, could ultimately change the political landscape as President Rousseff faces a re-election battle in October. And, of course, the first thing many people do in epic losses or wins is try to compare them to past events.
So take us back in history for a moment then, David, and give us an example of a sporting loss that really was just devastating for a country.
Well, Marco, one devastating loss would have to be looking at the 1990 soccer match between Serbia's Red Star Belgrade and Croatia's Dinamo Zagreb. During the game, future AC Milan and Croatia captain Zvonimir Boban actually launched a jump kick at a policeman who was attacking a Zagreb fan. And while pro-independence parties had already won Croatian elections just weeks before that match, it is widely regarded as sparking the most vicious European war since the Nazis were defeated in 1945.
So we're talking the Balkans here, right? I mean, this is the 1990s, and that was a vicious war. All started by a soccer match?
Right. Certainly there were other influences at that time, and ethnic tensions were already at its height in Yugoslavia, but many point to that moment as a turning point and a catalyzing moment that launched into that war.
Yeah, that's incredible. Well, on the other side, a victory that had an impact, also a background note here of a war, but this is Iraq's victory in the 2007 Asian Cup final versus Saudi Arabia. And as I said, the background note here is this is in the midst of the U.S. occupation of Iraq. What happened?
Right, and given the crisis in Iraq now, it's easy to forget this game. But in 2007, the Iraq team, which was made up of Kurds, Sunni, and Shia Muslims, defeated Saudi Arabia at a moment in which they were facing fierce ethnic factionalism and a war with the U.S. back home. And afterward, and you may remember seeing some coverage of it, there were mass celebrations in the streets of Baghdad, in the sense that a soccer game had, at least momentarily, created what no politician could, and that was a semblance of national unity.
Wow, Iraq could use a victory like that right now. David Conrad, the world's Google Fellow, thank you.
Thank you.
Again, you can see David's graphic at PRI.org. Football Wars and the Hand of God, it's all there. Let's go back now to our friend Izzy the Ocelot. You heard how Izzy predicted Germany for the World Cup win on Sunday. Sorry about that, Argentina. Now let's hear Izzy's other big announcement. Break out the cigars. Here's Franklin Park zookeeper Nikki Smith with the news.
We have an ocelot kitten. Izzy is a dad again. This is his fifth kitten here. It's his second daughter. He had a daughter and then three sons and now another daughter. So we're very excited for him and PJ, his mate.
Smith tells us the little kitten is spunky, but she needs a name. And that's where you can help, listeners. Head to our Facebook page with your best names for Izzy the Ocelot's little girl. We'll announce the winner next week. If she's teething a lot, I think the name's pretty obvious. Luisa Suarez. Sorry, that episode still has some bite. Give us your best shot at a name at facebook.com/PRI the world. Sick of soccer? How about a little ballroom dancing? With some controversy thrown in for good measure. In the UK, competitive ballroom dancing is regulated by the British Dance Council, and the council has just got itself into a fine mess. It's considering rule changes that would define a dance partnership as one man and one lady, unless otherwise stated. The reason for this is that more and more same-sex dance partners are competing against mixed-sex couples, and some of those couples felt that two men dancing together have an unfair advantage in competitions. The British Dance Council says it comes down to physique. In a letter to members, it said that competition organizers should consider the advantage that physical strength and stamina give a same-sex couple over rival dancers.
I completely disagree with that.
That's John Church, one half of Britain's top all-male ballroom couples.
Dancing is not about strength. It is not about power. It is about dance technique. It's about floor craft. It's about presentation, poise and posture, and correct use of the feet and legs. It has nothing to do with strength. If that were the case, then we would be expecting all the very large couples to be winning all the championships, and that doesn't happen.
Church says the proposed new rule has more to do with the ballroom dancing establishment being stuck in the past. But he says audience attitudes toward him and his dance partner are changing.
People often come up to us and say that they think it's wonderful seeing two men dancing together, and they are very accepting of it. It's only a very small minority of people that dislike this. But unfortunately, that small minority of people seem to have strong voices, and they're being heard.
The British Dance Council will vote on its proposal later this month. If it passes, same-sex couples would be barred from mainstream contests, relegating them to same-sex-only categories. We've been hearing a lot lately on the world about the wave of Central American immigrants reaching our southern border, especially the unaccompanied kids. Today we want to focus on one country where many of those immigrants are coming from, Honduras. There's a police unit there called the Honduran Special Tactical Operations Unit. It used to focus on drug smugglers. Its mission now is to help stop Honduran children from heading north. And the special unit is trained and paid for by the U.S. government. Cindy Carcamo of the L.A. Times discovered that while reporting from Honduras.
My colleague Don Bartletti and I, who's a photographer, we were actually going to visit a source that we wanted to speak with. And in front of the hotel that he was staying in, there were these guys that look like almost like border patrol agents. And I was just kind of staring at them, and actually I tripped in front of them. They all kind of looked at me strangely and started laughing, and I kind of laughed back. And then I saw that one of them, well, actually all of them, the BORTAC, there was like this BORTAC.
That's the acronym for this, yeah, this group. This unit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, actually BORTAC is a special division of U.S. Border Patrol. And they had the patch on the side of their arm. So I recognized that, and I thought, huh, that's really interesting. You know, are these, what's U.S. Border Patrol doing here in Honduras? But you know, I got to talking with them, and it turns out that they're trained by BORTAC in the United States. In the United States, BORTAC comes to San Pedro Sula or to other areas, Tegucigalpa, and trains them there.
Right. So these guys were kind of tough looking. Were they? I mean, describe them.
Yeah. I mean, really fit, young, tough looking. You know, they stood out. They weren't your typical Latin American police officials that are kind of ragtag sometimes. You know, they were very well suited. They just had a different look to them than your normal police in Latin America. And also, they were wearing these bulletproof vests that said police in the front as well. So they definitely stuck out.
Right. Well, as far as U.S. funding this special police unit, how new is that?
Well, they've been funding, these special units for a while now. It seems like some of the documents that my colleague Brian Bennett was able to get shows that they've been funded for a few years now. As to this operation and how much funding they're actually getting for this special operation, that's unclear. The State Department wouldn't get back to us on that information. Just to give you a sense of what the United States is paying for, is most of these guys' uniform is actually paid for by the U.S. State Department. The SUVs that they ride in are paid for by U.S. officials. They have this huge X-ray, like scanner vehicle that's about $1 million that's paid for by U.S. officials. So, I mean, they make no qualms about it, that they're U.S. trained. And actually, they're very proud of it, because it distinguishes them from, you know, other police officials in the country.
But now they're kind of shifting gears, and they're focusing less on drugs and focusing more on these kids trying to get across the border. Why is the U.S. covering these costs for this mission?
It was about 3 months ago that the head of the National Police Agency noticed that there was an uptick in children leaving the country. And so when the surge happened, and, you know, America awoke to, you know, all of these children coming through on the Rio Grande Valley, he decided to ask the U.S. Embassy for help. And the U.S. Embassy obliged, and they said yes, they would, and that's when this team was dispatched to do the special operation, Operation Rescue Children.
So, did you see a lot of solo kids along the border trying to get across?
Not at the border. The kids that we did see were actually at the checkpoints before the actual border, mothers with children. You know, some of them had the proper documentation, but others didn't. We spoke with one mother who was bound for Los Angeles, for instance, who didn't have the proper documentation for her little boy, who's 2 years old. And she was stopped, and she was sent back to San Pedro Sula.
With her kid?
Yes.
And in the meantime, the triggers, like gang violence in San Pedro Sula, that seem to be scaring these kids away, that continues.
Yes, it does. It does continue. And that's what people are, you know, that's what people talk about here, is that these kids are going to keep going no matter what, unless something is done in the country to fix or to kind of help relieve the whole poverty situation and also the violence.
Cindy Carcamo is the Arizona Bureau Chief for the LA Times. She's been speaking with us from San Pedro Sula, Honduras. Cindy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. If you know this classic Jamaican pop tune, My Boy Lollipop by Millie Smalls, then you've heard the guitar of our final guest today on The World, 82-year-old Ernest Ranglin. You can barely hear his guitar there on My Boy Lollipop. It would have been like getting Jimi Hendrix to back up the Ronettes. But from his early calling as a jazz guitarist to one of Jamaica's key innovators of ska and a regular session man at the famous Studio One recording house in Kingston, Ernest Ranglin is the man. We had the treat recently of welcoming him here at The World. Let's just start with a taste of what we got to hear when Ranglin came in, a perfect summertime riff from a song he wrote called Follow On. It's not often we get to welcome a living legend in our studio at The World. Today we do, though. Ernest Ranglin, he's the one on lead guitar there. Also have Tony Mandel on rhythm guitar and Jonathan Cordy on the melodica. Ernest Ranglin, thank you for coming in. It's great to meet you.
It's great to be here also. Thank you for welcoming me.
Now, we're in a radio studio, obviously. And in the old days, radio stations used to have their own bands, like in-house bands that they needed music programming, they were there to play. In fact, you used to do this for the Jamaican Broadcasting Corporation, I recently learned, in the 50s and 60s. How did that actually work? Did you kind of just sit around waiting for them to say, we need some music, and then you'd play?
Well, to begin with, you have to be able to play at least one instrument and maybe an arranger. I think about three instruments. So I used to play the bass, I play the guitar, and I'm an arranger. So that's how I was able to work at that station.
When did the JBC stop using live musicians in their studio?
Maybe around early 60s. Mm.
So you were one of the last ones, if maybe not the last one.
We had a group there, about 16 of us, regular jazz band, and we played for the programs and the radio show. And then we always go and do these other things and stage with artists, whatever artists we could find, we go and do shows and stage with them.
So once you get to Studio One, was that for survival? Did you want to play reggae, or was it really kind of...
I was still a jazz musician at that time, but to begin with, I am the first person who started ska. And then from ska, we went to reggae. And during those days, there was a lot of whatever recording studio that came into being. I generally was the musical director for most of them because there weren't much arrangers around at that time. And like Bob Marley and the Wailers and a lot of artists who first started, so many of them, I can't even remember names, but Studio One was one of the main studios that brought up big hits for local artists.
Well, you're 82 years old now, and I know our listeners aren't here in the studio, but we will have some pictures of you online. You do not look 82. I mean, you're more like a 65-year-old man, and you play guitar with that same kind of younger spirit. Now, you've performed improvisational jazz. You've done bebop, reggae, rocksteady, ska, mento. Yeah. Today, when you play guitar, what do you always go back to? What is your musical style that you prefer?
Well, I don't really. I just love to portray what is being necessary to do at that moment. You know, if it's something like African or calypso or reggae or Latin, I try to play nearly every style. So because of that, I try to suit the moment. Let's put it that way.
Well, you have certainly suited our moment here at The World Today, Ernest Ranglin. Thank you so much for coming to the studio. It's a real honor to meet you.
Oh, you're very welcome, son. I really appreciate being here, and I hope to be here some other time again. And it's great to meet a great gentleman like you.
Thank you so much. Come again soon.
Yeah, thanks.
Ernest Ranglin has a new album out. It's a great summertime jam called Bless Up. And this is one of the standout tracks, I think, El Mescalero. It shows how even at 82, Ernest Ranglin continues to innovate. I mean, come on, tango reggae? And it sounds great. So sweet. That'll do it for us here at The World. We filmed Ernest Ranglin's performance here at the Nan and Bill Harris Studios. You can see him in all his glory at PRI.org. And don't forget to follow The World when we're not on the radio. Find us at facebook.com/PRI The World and follow us on Twitter and Instagram too at PRI The World. I mow my own lawn on Twitter and Instagram. You can find me at both as well at Marco Werman. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. It's Friday, people, so have a great weekend. We're back with you right here on the radio on Monday.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers, and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. By the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor. The PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.